You're listening to WOOL 91.5 FM in Bellows Falls, Vermont. The What's My Wine group is going to be looking at the Mâcon region, a region known for beautiful and complex white wines. We'll be discussing the grape and the terroir with our friends Joe Canini, Larry Burdick, and Keith Zimmerman. We do not put ourselves forward in any way as being experts about wines and winemaking, but we completely appreciate getting together with friends, good food, and opening interesting bottles of wine. So with that, Larry, can you talk to us a little bit about the Mâcon region? This was sort of your idea to explore Mâcon. The little that I know is that this region is near Burgundy. I think it borders Burgundy and Beaujolais, and it's just south and maybe, what, slightly west of the Jura. And once again, this is a very, very small parcel of land in the grand scheme of things, but known for some remarkable, beautiful white wines.
So the Mâcon is part of Burgundy. It's just north of Beaujolais. If you go through the Côte Chalonnaise, which is the southern part of Burgundy, you'll come into the Mâcon. And then if you keep going south, you'll go into Beaujolais. So they're considered Burgundy wines. Actually have a very large production. When you say it's a small region, probably it is geographically, but I think they have a ton of production. In the last 15 years, they've been improving the quality of wine. It used to be known as a vin de soif or a vin de carafe, and you would find them in every cafe in France would sell a cheap glass of Mâcon white
and
wine.
And just to clarify, the vin de carafe, that's just a carafe of wine that's plunked down on the table.
It's for
the
instance,
house wine.
Local yeah. wine, yeah.
Yeah.
Local wine, very local wine.
Which often is
the best.
The best, yeah.
Yeah, often it is. But it was also so affordable that, you know, every cafe in France was able to order a glass at a very affordable price. It seemed to me, I just found them everywhere in the 70s, for instance, and 80s. You know, in Burgundy in general, there's a few lesser known regions in Burgundy that allow you to buy great wines that are super interesting, Burgundian, and at a great price. Up around Chablis, you have the Auxerre region where you can buy wines like an Erancy. Have you guys heard of Erancy?
Yeah, I have, yeah.
Or a Saint-Brie.
Saint-Brie, yeah.
These are very affordable wines. They're not very known, but they've historically been part of Burgundy forever. I believe some people say the renommé of Burgundy began up in that region just southwest of Chablis. But anyhow, what I'm trying to get at is there's great wines at great prices to be had in Burgundy. If you start in that northern region just near Chablis, then you come down the Côte de Nuit, it's called.
Yes.
Then you have the Côte de Beaune, and then you have the Côte Chalonnaise. Then you come down to Mâcon. Those are all incredibly interesting and delicious wines that don't cost a lot of money.
Is it appropriate to say that these are wines that are made sort of in the Burgundian style, whatever that might mean, but they're not necessarily priced as a Burgundy, as a white Burgundy would be? Is that way of saying it?
I think you could say that, yeah. For instance, the Côte Chalonnaise Mâcon, they're Chardonnays.
Pinot Noir and Gamay.
Pinot yeah. Noir, Gamay, and yeah. Chardonnay, that's it.
That's it.
Yeah.
Those are the three grapes
all the way
that we're talking
from
about.
From far north in Chablis to the far south of Mâcon.
I mean, Saint-Brie is the exception because there's Sauvignon Blanc there. But
there's a couple exceptions in that area southwest of Chablis, but it's still considered Burgundy.
Yep.
But I guess what I'm saying is, so Mâcon is in that category of great wines you can find that have great gastronomic value for the money.
Through history, I think that's been the case, right? I think the Dukes of Burgundy were all housed in Dijon, which is at the far north. I mean, Chablis is a little bit further to the north and the west. It kind of sits by itself, amazing wines there. But the Dukes of Burgundy were in Dijon, and Mâcon was all the way in the south of their kingdom, and they didn't pay that much attention to it. Some of those areas that Larry mentioned, Côte de Nuit, Côte de Beaune, together those are called the Côte d'Or, the Gold Coast.
Mm,
and those were proximate to Dijon. And that's where the investment, I think, went, and that's where he was really paying attention to the prices of the wine, because that all accrued to the kingdom at some point through taxes or duties or whatever. And the Mâconnais, all the way down in the south, were wines that were left to the people who were growing them. And oftentimes the yields were very high because they were just having the wines for themselves. It wasn't so much an export market for them at that point in time. Mâconnais then, after the revolution, all those vines went back to the people, north and south. The Duke didn't have anything to do with it anymore. But the Mâconnais kind of really took possession of their own future at that point in time. Mâconnais became a big trading center for the wines, and I think the economics of everything got better in the south. But the wines themselves are beautiful, based on the same grapes as the super expensive, in a relative basis, wines to their north. There's maybe a little less nuance, a little less greatness, but at the same time, they're beautiful wines. They're beautiful
and beautiful with food.
Beautiful with food. There's no doubt about that. Yeah.
You had made a point earlier, Joe, about how a lot of these wines, that these wine regions, they're named for the prime city that has become the commercial hub, the trading hub throughout history.
Mâconnais, for sure, because I think Mâconnais is the only village in this whole area that doesn't have any grapes around it.
It's
on the river. All the Mâconnais is, as Larry mentioned, it's south, and it's south of the river Saône, I think it's pronounced.
Yes, S-O-N-N-E.
And that would have been the waterway that would have the grease to the skids of the money.
Right, and it flows into the Rhône River.
Yeah, and they go south. And there were canals at that point in time. There were more ways to get their wine to the market, and they were not blocked by anybody. It thrived.
So, Keith, can you talk a little bit about the characteristics of those three grapes that you talked about, that you mentioned as being the primary, the backbone of this region?
It's hard to say. I mean, the Chardonnay is the white grape of the Burgundy, along with a little bit of Aligoté. Aligoté is a little, what would you say, Larry? It's a little more acidic. It's not quite as...
Leaner.
Leaner, yeah. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have the same...
That's a good adjective, yeah.
...forwardness of the fruit.
Leaner is perfect.
Mm-hmm.
But in the Burgundy, the Chardonnay, it's not really a fair comparison to California, where the wines are very tropical fruits kind of flavor. The wines coming out of Burgundy tend to be have a mineral characteristic,
which I love.
Them.
I happen to love that.
And then in the Mâconnais, it's warmer than up in the northern part of Burgundy, so the wines are a little fleshier, a little more fruit forward there. The Pinot Noir is a red grape, and the Gamay is a red grape. So those don't play a very big part in the wine production in the Mâconnais. A little bit, but not too much. So it's I don't know what the percentage is, but I'm guessing it's 90% white and maybe 10%.
I think the Dukes of Burgundy had a big interest in making sure that Gamay, which was a very 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 prolific grower, had an interest in not letting Gamay go northward into Pinot Noir, because that was where their real bread and butter was on the Côte d'Or. So Gamay, I think, has become an amazing grape as it's been tamed back. And some of it, I think, has been replaced by Chardonnay in terms of what can be sold and what people are having. You go further south into Beaujolais, you get a great expression of Gamay that has really stood the test of time in many ways.
So we have five wines that we're going to be tasting. This first one is Cave de Lugny, La Côte Blanche, and it's an unoaked Chardonnay, very, very reasonably priced white wine, sort of like a workhorse wine. You could serve this with a lot of different types of food.
Bistro wine, as Larry said before, great bistro wine.
Yeah, bistro wine. And this is 13% alcohol. And one reason why we mention the alcohol level is because it really influences the overall taste and character of the wine. Wines that are high in alcohol tend to be heavier, more fruit-forward, and the leaner wines tend to be less alcohol heavy. Anyway, so here we are with the 100% Chardonnay. And Larry, you were the one who introduced this idea of looking at the Mâconnais region. How are you experiencing this wine?
I find the alcohol not being quite integrated. I'm not sure why. It does have at the end that characteristic Mâconnais flavor. I'm not enjoying it immensely. Let me take another smell and taste. Give me
but that's
just,
an
I think
interesting.
That alcohol point is.
Yeah, that is super interesting.
It has nothing to do
yeah.
with what Cynthia was saying about the amount of alcohol
correct.
In the wine. It's how the wine is, how the flavors are integrated.
But and how does that happen, Keith, with from,
I'm
the,
not sure.
from the vintner's I mean, perspective?
You know,
what's
that,
going on?
That I don't know. Mm. I don't know how to answer that.
I mean,
that
this wine would fall into the close to the like more mass-produced wine.
I think that's probably
And I think that could be part of it. And yeah. and I don't know what they're allowed to do here, but in some cases, the alcohol is boosted in wine by adding chaptalization sugar, really. And I don't know if that's the case here, but it wouldn't surprise me. If I had a breast of chicken with a little sauce on it, I'd enjoy this wine. By itself, I agree, it's kind of...
It's a little flat. A little disappointing. But one could cook with this.
I hesitate to be critical because whoever made this wine probably worked hard at it. So, but there's some other flavors going on that I am not liking that aren't integrated also into an overall flavor that I would like to see. But that's just me. I don't know a lot about
it. I agree yeah. with you, Larry, though. I yeah. mean, I think Joe's mm-hmm. points well. This is a big producer. Mm-hmm. I don't think the same care. You know, a small producer, really, the reputation is all about his name on the label or her name on the label. And in this case, this is a big big producer.
Is that the wine that's marked? Yeah, the Luni.
Yes.
The Cave de Luni.
Mm-hmm, yeah. mm-hmm.
I know there's some very good wines that have the Luni name on them somewhere. I mean, wouldn't shy away from a Luni in the future.
Of right, course.
This, I mean, this
course.
Producer does have a Macon Luni, which is the town, which is the region.
Right.
Luni is the
I've
region.
I've tasted that, yeah.
And okay. it may be very good.
The Cave de Luni might be where the juice is fermented from a lot of other places.
Like a cooperative.
A cooperative. I mean, mm-hmm. that's probably a great way to describe this, because I bet you that's how yeah. it's made. And grapes coming from various vineyards,
right.
not necessarily from the village of Macon Luni.
Right. No, in fact, they say on the label that it's Camper. Closer to the village of Chardonnay.
Oh, so it'd be further north.
Also, that's probably being bottled under other labels also.
Is this a wine that will mm-hmm. taste differently tomorrow, or is there just... Do you think this is kind of it?
I think this is it.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, Joe, what is the next bottle that we have?
Now we're going to Macon Village, which is a step up certainly from the Macon itself, right? And this is from a négociant that would be pretty familiar to anyone who's been a wine shop, Louis Jadot, who we talked about before, is an amazing négociant based in Beaune, France. So his first love is Burgundy. So he represents, as a négociant, lots of smaller producers, buys production, bottles it under his labeling. And I think as large négociants go, he's very well distributed all throughout the United States. It's hard to go wrong with a Jadot wine. It really is. They're very consistent. There's a stylistic, but let's see what we have here.
While we do this next tasting, I just want to remind everyone that you're listening to WOOL 91.5 FM radio in Bellows Falls. And the program today is all about the region called Macon in France. And we're tasting a flight of five different wines made in the Macon region, featuring primarily the Chardonnay grape. So we've tried one, and then in this second one that is the Macon Village, Joe, tell us again why the including the name village or village on the label actually is an indicator of a step up.
My understanding is the village wines have more of a terroir-specific identity. Oftentimes, the villages are on slightly higher ground. The land below them would be a little lesser quality wines, still good, but lesser quality as you get into the village. Much like you in the Cru Beaujolais, you're working your way in altitude. And so I think in quality can change. But more importantly, I think you can recognize certain villages when you've had them before. But my first taste in the glass, I found a significant difference between the first wine.
Significant.
And this one. And I'm quite enjoying this one, actually.
It says that this particular wine is made without oak contact to maximize its vibrant flavor. So the oak would have sort of tamped it down a little bit with the tannic contribution. Is that what they're...
It would have added different things to it for sure. And you know, the great point about that is the first one was stainless steel. This one is stainless steel, no oak. So it's interesting how different they are with the same vinification going on.
And they're both 13% alcohol.
But
13, I'm finding that the Macon Village, it has these bright, bright notes, like green apple notes. That's not the overarching thing. There is structure to this wine, and there's a beautiful middle tone to it. It's quite lovely. Keith, what are you tasting?
Getting into the details of the tasting, it's really, it's, you know, so personal in many respects. And, you know, I just think if you're, this wine would be fine to drink without food. It'd be nice to have a little something to eat with it, but it would go great with any meal you might want to have.
I'm thinking roast chicken. Would be really amazing chicken with roasted potatoes and chicken.
Yeah, I agree. It's a food. It's a very correct wine, and we should be having it with food.
I'm thinking like a pork tenderloin with lemon.
There is a little
that citrus,
underlying citrus note here, which is really sweet, very nice, almost like a tangerine.
But it has enough body that it can really, it could stand up to something a little bit more substantial.
That's a big difference, right? The mouthfeel of this one is so different than the first one, which was very 1 minute. It's there and then it's gone. And this one has something that cerebral.
Well, it's lingering. You know, it's still on the palate. So that's an indicator that there's, you know, there's what I keep referring to as some structure to the wine. I don't know if that's even a correct word to use, but that's what occurs to me, you know, as I'm tasting it.
It's correct. I've had it enough that to me, this Marcon Village from Louis Jadot is typical of what Marcon Village is on this level of production. We're going to taste another wine that might be totally different. That's also a Marcon Village. In terms of quality, it might be very different. But it's got that classic Marcon taste. You know, Louis Jadot, we said this earlier, that they have simple and correct wines, and then they have some wines that are great and everything in between. So this is a food-friendly, tastes like Marcon, balanced wine. Some citrus notes.
I would just think, like, if I went into a bistro, the first wine would be probably the one that would be the inexpensive glass of Vin Blanc that you have standing up at the bar on the way somewhere else.
On the motorway.
On the motorway. At 9 in the morning, the truck driver stopping for the Vin Blanc, the Vin Rouge.
Oh, man. Boom.
You know, it's interesting. Just talking about price, I forget what the price was on this bottle, but when I had a house in Coucy and Morvan, which is on the edge of Burgundy, I brought a gift to my neighbor of a Marcon Village, and he asked me what I had spent on it. It was 16 euros. It was a real good one. He was shocked. He never bought Marcons for more than 10 euros. He was like, what? You spent that much on a bottle of Marcon? Just to give you the idea psychologically.
It's the people's wine.
It's the people's
wine.
They
feel like they own it and they work it. And that's always been, through history, I think that's been the case. So
well, until recently, there were no Premier Cru. There are no Grand Cru.
Right.
And there are no, they're just recently, I think maybe, was it this year? This year they're bottling some, or they're possibly selling.
I think it's Premier. Before this year, but I forget when, Keith. But it's recent.
But it's been recent, yeah.
Yeah. But that gets back to also the notion that winemakers had a realization that they could just up their game a little by being more careful in the winemaking, or separating themselves out from the cooperative and then, you know, giving extra care to their production. So Marcon's one of those regions that's improving a lot still, and has been for the last 10 years.
Less wine is going to cooperatives, and so many small family holdings have now found a way.
Yeah.
Well, it's
some
that
way
emphasis
to bottle
on
their own wine.
Yeah,
the last two generations have said, "I'm going to make my own wine
exactly,
and get more money for
exactly.
it,
exactly,
and
right.
do something special on top of it all." Yeah. Forgive me, Cynthia.
To make a point about this, the trend towards the artisanal and things that
That's
are really
right.
crafted.
That's what it is.
And that was something that struck me about your comment, Larry, about Louis Jadot. I look at that label and I think, oh, that, you know, it's a huge producer. My default is to want to find the more unique bottle, the you know, something from a smaller producer, an artisanal producer. Mm-hmm. But this is testament that, you know, this particular wine, this Marcon Village from Louis Jadot, is really, it's lovely and it's holding up in the glass.
It's a good value
for
what it is.
Yeah, it's a very, very good value. Pay. Yes, yeah. For the next bottle, I think this is also a Marcon, the Domaine Corsin.
2023.
Yes, and the one that we just tasted was also 2023. So this is almost like a side-by-side comparison, except Louis Jadot, big producer, and this wine would be perhaps
small
from a smaller family producer.
I don't know anything about the producer, but this is probably someone who decided not to be part of a co-op at some part of his family's history and decided to make wine to be bottled by themselves.
I would say this is like so clean.
Clean mouthfeel is just, you get a little unctuous and
beautiful.
Boy, the nose is just beautiful, isn't it? There's so much information there and it's so pleasing. It's lovely.
I think, Larry, you and I have probably had 6, 7, 8 vintages of this wine. I mean, I have over the years.
Joe, this is my first time.
First time.
Believe it or not, yeah.
Well, Corsin also makes wine in Saint-Vrain. Really good winemaking. Paying attention there, again, their production is not gigantic. It would be more like the Mary Taylor Co. or, you know, just sort of that negotiation, small properties that they're trying to help to get to a market.
And Joe, is this a negotiation too, Joe?
I think Corsin is.
Because they have
Saint-Vrain, or they own, or it's a family that owns several properties in several villages. That could also be the case, and they just bought a, like the Mary Taylor ones. He had vineyards in 2 separate spots in Cahors. And
so what is the other wine that you're mentioning that is made by Corsin?
Saint-Vrain, which is another village.
So it's Saint-Vrain, V-E-R-A-N.
And a separate village.
And also the same grape, or no?
Also the same grape, Chardonnay. Uh-huh.
But different growing conditions.
Just a different village, different terroir. Yeah. Yeah. I think, as I recall, the Saint-Vrain was maybe a little bit more linear with more of an acidic ending. But again, these wines are...
And Joe, this is also in the Mâcon.
Also in the Mâcon,
So it's a village in the Mâcon.
Saint-Vrain is a smaller area than Mâcon Village would be.
Yeah.
And it's further to the south, and it actually borders Beaujolais.
Okay, but it is in the Mâcon region.
It is in the Mâcon, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's just one of the specific villages.
Correct.
Within Mâcon.
And as you get named specific villages, I think control and possibly the quality is better.
Which we'll be moving to specific villages next.
I read that the Saint-Vrain is the most recent appellation to get the nomination.
1971, I think.
I find the Saint-Vrains, we'll talk about it again later, I guess, to have this floral quality that is very unique in Mâcon. Yeah. And I just love that. The mouthfeel in this wine is wonderful. There's almost a sweetness, but it's perfectly balanced out by the other fruit and acidity flavors. So
it's a little riper fruit.
That's the word I'm looking for.
So the fruit is really balanced beautifully with something else that's creating a nice nuance to this wine.
I get minerals. I get almost like slate rocks. Again, that doesn't sound very attractive, does it? But and that's what Chablis far to the north would be described. Many people
flinty
taste it. It's like flinty. It's interesting that they still this. Much further south, it has similar characteristics.
That front taste of the bit riper fruit, apple-y kind of thing, that finishes with that nice mineral characteristic.
I don't know what 23 was versus 22 in terms of years, but the village is 22. This one's 23. This could be just a warmer summer, you know, just riper fruit.
Well, so we'll take just one moment to remind everybody that we're listening to What's My Wine with Keith Zimmerman, Larry Burdick, and Joe Canini, and myself, Cynthia Reeves. The topic that we're looking at in today's episode concerns the Mâcon region in France, beautiful, beautiful countryside adjacent to the Burgundy region. And we're looking at a flight of wines that are mainly comprised of the Chardonnay grape. And Keith, remind me again, the other two grapes that are predominant are?
The other white grape would be Alicote.
I think something like 11% or something like that of the production would be Alicote.
So we just did a program on the Cahors. We tasted wines over a 20-year span. We've had 3 wines now, and they're 2023 and 2022. So let's talk a little bit about why white wines typically are not aged maybe as much as some of the red grape wines. Is there anything that one could deduce from this, or is there a fragility to this grape that means that it should be consumed without a lot of age on it typically?
I think the only stab I'll take at that is that I think so far most of the wines we've had have been predominantly stainless steel. And as wood is introduced and great vinification and great fruit, the potential to age white wines is quite amazing. But that's not what these wines are intended for.
Most winemakers are making the whites to be consumed early. It's their decision. There are certainly exceptions to that rule. There's some Burgundian wines. I don't know about the Mâcon specifically, but there's certainly Burgundian wines that can last age well for 10, 15 years. Yeah. Other parts of France, Hermitage whites can have the long aging capability. Riesling in Germany can
age
like a long time.
It's like it's a linear sort of relationship, price point and aging potential. It must be said that some of the wines in the Côte d'Or, the white wines, et cetera, are astronomical in price, and those are the ones that will age. And if you do get a chance, it's quite a sublime experience, or it can be. It can also be a disappointing experience, because wine
spent
is
that
a
much
wine.
Money on that one.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But what we're talking about and what we have talked about all through this program is it's approachable wines, both in terms of
price point.
The palate and the price point.
Comment that's really coming from ignorance. I don't know scientifically at all if what I'm saying makes sense, but I think red wines have certain things going on in them that white wines don't have that allow them maybe to age longer. And now I just speak as someone who drinks wines. I have no idea about winemaking or the chemistry of it all. But the oldest wine I ever drank was a Riesling, a white wine from Alsace, which was remarkable.
And what age did it have on it? Do you remember? Or?
I think it had 40 years on it, and it was just a remarkable...
Was it dry or off-dry?
It was almost off-dry, Joe. I'm trying to remember the exact wine. But you would think maybe it wasn't a super dry wine, but it was just under the super dry sugar content level, I guess I would say. But maybe red wines have a lot other things going on in them that white wines don't have.
A lot
is that
more
possible?
Skin contact, a lot more skin contact, more tannins. Tannins are a big
preservative. And in the whites, it is. That's a good question, Joe, about the sugar. Because it's the acidity and the sugar that help the white wines
to live longer.
To live a long time.
Yeah, the super dry ones tend to oxidize off if with too much time. And when we say dry and off dry, just, dry is vinified till basically all the sugars are vinified out, and what's left is alcohol, and it's in some percentage as low as 11 or 12, and sometimes it's as high as 14.5 or 15, which is really borders on almost the port, which port is 16.5 for fortified wine. But off-dry would be a descriptor that would say there's a little bit more residual sweetness in this wine, a little bit more residual sweetness. And if the wine has acidity to start, it's a magical balance. You've got the acidity of the wine, the sugars to keep it fresh and alive, but you then have years of bottle age that bring nuance of amazing complexity.
Well, I like the way that you phrase that it seems to me that the sugars should be in service of the wine, not the leading edge of the wine. The sugars are there to create kind of like the backbone.
Mm-hmm. Now, the sugar really is there to create a stable wine. It varies a little bit depending on the acidity, but in general, you're trying to get a stable product. I mean, if you look back historically. So
for shipping and everything
else. For shipping and everything else. So you want to have the kind of the minimum 18 to 19% sugar in the grape before you ferment it. It's better if you can get something in the 21 to 23 or 4
Is that what they talk
range.
About when people say bricks?
Yeah,
is that
that's what they're talking about?
That's
what they call
bricks. So the acidity provides kind of almost the backdrop to that sugar.
The other very old white wines I remember having were from Vouvray in the Loire Valley.
Chenin Blanc.
Yes. All, again, were off dry. They weren't
then big bricks to start.
Or even a little sweeter. And they seem to age wonderfully.
So the Mâcon, this region is adjacent to Burgundy. And there are some white Burgundies that can be cellared for a very long time. And those are wines that I always equate with a kind of a buttery quality to them. They can be so fulsome. And this Mâcon wine is decidedly different in characteristic, and it's their shoulder to shoulder in terms of the terroir. The next wine that we're going to taste, it's all Chardonnay, is Viret Classé. This is a 13.5% alcohol. The first three were just 13. So a wine with a little bit more fortitude. It's a 2022, so these are still all within the same, almost 12-month period in terms of their aging.
The one thing I'm getting here on first approach that I didn't get in any of the other ones is a little bit of salinity, you know, a little salt, almost like a vague saltiness to
it. I agree, and it's welcome.
Very attractive. That could be coming just from more limestone. And very cliche, I think, is a village named of two villages that used to be separate. Keith, is that
That's
what you
correct.
Remember?
That's my understanding.
So Viret, the village of Viret and Classe.
Yeah. They're next to one another or mm-hmm. very close. And
also pretty far south in the Mâcon.
And the way that these words are spelled, it's sometimes helpful to hear it's V-I-R-E is the name of one village, and then C-L-E-S-S-E, Classe, is the second. And this vintner is André Bonhomme.
What a nice name.
Yes.
André Goodman.
Goodman.
It's a beautiful name.
Man.
I'm going to change André. My name to Bonhomme.
Bonhomme. Wow. Yeah, this is lovely and very, very different in character than the prior wine.
I would describe this wine in relation to the other ones as the most pretty wine we've had so far. Very, very feminine. It's not one that's attacking. It's very subtle, but it's really well balanced.
Yeah, it's just this lovely sweetness around the edges.
Yeah. It's kind of
elegant. It kind of balances everything out. It's just beautiful.
Elegant, yeah. Mm-hmm. Really superb food wine.
And that little salinity in the background is great.
Can anyone say Coquille Saint-Jacques? Like a beautiful scallop with this.
Scallop dish.
Man, that would be really good.
So what are the foods from the Mâcon?
Bresse is to the west. So Poulet de Bresse is a very, very famous chicken, renowned all over France.
Good. I mean, roast chicken amazing. Would be delicious with this.
Even
the scallops would be great.
The little white wine sauce, a little anything you want to do with it.
The charcuterie is famous for the charcuterie in that region.
What do you think about like a canelle or something like that? Well, or sole? I mean, from the sea maybe, but freshwater fish. Yeah, would be
you
great.
You know, there's some soft cow cheeses from that area that are well known. I forget if the Marcelin is from that area, but it might be.
But I can understand why the Marcelin would come to mind. Because cheese with this wine, I think, would be just totally beautiful.
Yeah, and that's something to be noted, too. I think once you get into the Mâcon area, there are some elevation changes and there are some hills, and the vines tend to take advantage of that. But beyond that, it's mixed agriculture through this area. I mean, crops, dairy. So there's lots going on. Animal husbandry.
Yeah, I think
Charolais is from
that area.
Which is a very famous beef breed.
Well, and I keep coming back to the fact that here we are once again talking about, like with Cahors, what is a relatively small plot of land in the grand scheme of things. I mean, we've tasted four expressions of the grape from this small area, and the differences among them are really quite extraordinary. I'm sure the Puy-Fouissé is going to add yet another layer of complexity to this tasting, but it just never ceases to amaze me how the characteristics of the land are expressed, but continuously, uniquely, in all these different wines, the wine being an expression of an artisanal hand of the land itself and of the legacy of winemaking in that region. And you can taste it in the bottle.
Yeah, and this goes back, as you mentioned, in the Cahors, when we discussed Cahors, the Celts or Celts established the villages or whatever.
Yes.
And the same in this area, in the Mâcon, it was the Celts first. And then the Romans came up.
And then the church.
And then the Gauls.
The churches came and plotted out all the properties. And
yeah, but the churches owned all the vineyards for the longest period of time. I mean, everything was in service to the church.
But this last comment on the very classe, it's very elegant. And as we taste it, it's all those aromas and flavors are becoming more integrated into a single impression, at least for me.
That's a nice way to put it. That's
pretty
great.
Pretty enjoyable.
Yeah, just lovely.
It's lovely, yeah.
So we talked at some length about the Louis Jadot Mâcon Village. Now we have a Puy-Fouissé. This is also offered through Louis Jadot, and it's a 2022, so we're still right in that 12-month period in terms of the age of the wine. This is 100% Chardonnay.
Should we bring up that, what people call malolactic fermentation?
I was going to ask Keith about
that,
actually.
Should we bring
that
up?
I think that's an interesting
thing. Does anyone understand how to explain?
Keith would be the only one. But, I mean, people, it's not, no, but
now we're diving deep. We're getting pretty deep.
But it is.
We might have to do that on a later show.
It may not be easy to describe, but I think it's easy to detect.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you have a wine that's really, really acidic and it's just kind of puckering your mouth, the bacteria that winemakers will use, and they'll put the wine through what's called a malolactic fermentation, and that changes the acidity. Like the wines that were in the stainless steel, I doubt they went through malolactic.
They didn't.
It's possible, but these wines from the village, or from the specific villages, possibly.
To me, when I taste a wine that has this, in addition to everything else, the end thing is this yeasted bread feel in your mouth and in the taste. To me, I'm like, that wine has gone through a malolactic fermentation. The acidity goes down. And there's something about the yeast that's been introduced or whatever was there, present. It happens sometimes in the bottle, sometimes in a barrel, right?
Preferably in the barrel.
Preferably because it can be an explosion of the bottle.
Yeah, or it can turn it cloudy.
Yeah.
You can see things problem.
To me, it's always pretty distinctive. It's bacteria.
So it's a secondary process after the vintner has determined the overall characteristic of the wine. This is another process to...
Yes,
sort
I mean, it's
temper the flavor of it.
The wine
in some
has gone through all its fermentation.
Yeah,
it's
the fruit has done what it can do.
It's done fermenting. Mm-hmm, the sugar has been consumed by the yeast.
Right,
and now the winemaker is deciding, well, I feel like this acidity is too sharp, and I want to soften it a bit.
Do you think the more important, expensive a wine is? It's more likely, especially in a white, to have undergone a malolactic fermentation and not necessarily.
I don't think necessarily. Yeah, I think it really depends on
where's the wine? Where are we going?
Yeah, where's the acid?
But that kind of decision would be made as the vintner is tasting the wine. And it's a decision that's like an artisanal decision according to me, his or her taste, right?
You can do the analysis. I mean, there, you know, certainly
chemical analysis.
You know, there's a lot of lab work in winemaking today. They want to be able to ship a stable wine, right? So, you know, they need to have some information about that wine chemically so they can make sure that the wine is stable in the bottle.
And ideally they want the consumer upon tasting to be able to recognize this is this producer's wine. So they try to make their wines recognizable over time. It doesn't mean they're the same every year, but there's a stamp. If they don't think they're going to come up with a wine that's representative of their terroir, they won't bottle it.
They won't bottle it, no.
They'll sell it off.
Most won't, many won't. And then they would sell that off in bulk.
To a cooperative.
Or to someone else, a négociant.
It was a challenging vintage or whatever.
They cover their cost for that year. They try to.
I mean, if anyone ever has the ability to go and visit some of these small winemakers in the countryside in France or Italy or wherever, it is eye-opening.
It'll be one of the most interesting things you'll ever do. Yeah,
it is. It's so interesting, and it is a work of the hand as well as the heart and taste, and it's an all-year-long process.
Well, I think you know, we didn't talk about it in this show, but in the Cahors show, you know, we discussed these... plots of land that have been in families for generations. But even in the ones that haven't been in generations, many people in those areas have grown up around the wine trade. So maybe they worked a summer or they walked out in the vineyard and they tasted the grapes as they were ripening. They've learned a lot just by being with their grandmother and their grandfather and their uncle and their aunt.
And then their uncle died and it was theirs. And like, let's be winemakers. And I think there's a lot of that, actually. It's a good... a generational movement throughout Europe in winemaking, and here too.
Yes,
it's happening here, but we just don't have the same
longevity in years. Yeah, experience.
But I think in France, it's hobbled by the fact that by law, as a plot of land is passed down from generation to generation, it has to be divided equally among the heirs, and so plots of land get fractured and divided off into smaller and smaller plots.
I think in Burgundy, that's been particularly the case, or in the
Smacon
region we're talking
recalling,
about, where things
get small holdings.
A lot of small holders. Versus Bordeaux, where they're owned by larger conglomerates or whatever. So
we should have a show of answering technical questions, maybe?
That would be great.
Wouldn't that be
nice? I'd love that, Mm-hmm. Like, Keith, a few minutes ago, you used the term oenologist, which is, you know, everybody in the wine world knows that term, but... you know, people may not.
The enologist is a wine scientist.
Exactly. So I agree with you, Larry. It'll be fantastic.
And it's that, a large expense to have the enologist come in and help them make their wine.
The big producers will have an enologist on staff. The smaller producers would contract. You know, the big producers will have their own bottling line, and the small producers will hire somebody that rolls in on a truck and
I think it's really
bottles their juice.
And then it's really cool. I that's what I love to see. I look at these domains. I think it was one of the Cahors thing, and it's a picture of them. And what you saw out back were very large pallets after pallet after pallet wrapped up all in plastic. And what they were bottles waiting for the bottling truck to come.
Empty.
Empty.
Empty bottles.
Waiting for the bottling truck to come, bottle the wine, and they'll label sometimes at the same exact time. And that's all under contract for bottling.
This is a different story, but I was with Larry in the Burgundian area, and I think Von Romane, Larry, and Guillaume Tardy was the winemaker. And we were in his cellar, and he was trying to determine which bottle he was going to bottle that year. Remember that, Larry? And he was, you know, the shape of the bottle was just, it was the Burgundian shape with the sloped shoulders. But, he was just trying to determine what the glass was going to be that this year on how he was going to label. And that's quite an expense for these winemakers. I mean, labels and capsules
expensive.
They're not cheap.
Well, and it's also, it's their face to the world. It's their marketing.
It's their face to the world.
That whole label.
Keith, that's the year he was changing his label.
Is that what it was? And so the shape of the bottle and the label were kind of integrated there, what he was going to do. What did he end up having a Burgundian, like a more bone? Because there's a slight differences north to south in how these things are bottle shapes.
You know, Guillaume's wines are the only wines I could offer a vertical tasting in because I get 6 bottles every year. They're slowly piling up in my cellar.
Good. I'm available.
I think that could be a show.
Yeah.
And Guillaume.
He has lands. He has lands in maybe 6 or 7 of the most important appellations in Burgundy, including Echezo. And
and
I have to say, he has a fils. Well, the audience is going to think this is a show by francophiles. We better slow down a little, maybe.
We haven't got to Italy yet.
Willamette Valley.
Right.
And this is Black Sheep Radio for those listening, and we're talking about wines from Mâcon. However, we've moved a little bit, and now we're talking about a vintner that's north of Mâcon. But the funny thing to me about Guillaume Tardy was Guillaume will drink these wines from Von Romane with a Big Mac, you know, a McDonald's Big Mac. And, you know, you think of having these wines with some very elaborate meal.
He does that to get a rise out of people. Like Echezo also, he'll drink his Echezos with a...
That's just kind of painful, actually.
It's interesting. I had a wonderful friend and mentor years ago who was quite a wine lover and a great cook. And we were working together and we were working long hours and we'd see each other after leaving at 11 o'clock at night or something and showing up again at 7:30 in the morning. The first one's in, and I would usually go in and say, "Well, Gordo, what did you do last night?" And he said, "Well, I got home about 11:30. He lived in New Jersey, just over the bridge. And you know, I got home last night and I was hungry, so I cooked myself a beautiful omelet with Gruyere cheese, and I ate it standing up at the sink with a bottle of Margaux. Did you drink the whole bottle?" He goes, "Yeah."
Wow.
I mean, I wasn't going to leave the Margaux. I said, "How was the omelet?" He said, "Perfect." And so, it's everything is in the eye of the beholder. They're all food. It's all like some of the most pleasurable experiences I have had with wine have been complete surprises. You know, that it's like, wow, where did this come from? You pull something from the basement or something and you say, "Well, this might be good with this," and it ends up something totally different because that's what the winemaker put in the bottle. And you never know. It is still comes down to a brilliance in winemaking. And sometimes some winemakers think the less you do, the better. I wouldn't disagree with that.
And, I wouldn't either. I mean, I think this is Larry's point about wines, you know, that are natural wines with the least amount of
manipulation.
Yeast. I mean, if you can, that is the best. And with the least amount of
intervention.
Intervention. Yeah. And in the vineyard too, because it is about healthy soils ultimately.
It is.
And, you know, what you're putting on the grapes is an issue. So anyway, that's another story.
In the few minutes that we have left, maybe we could take a taste of the Puy Fuissé, see how we like that relative to what I think has been the standout so far is the Verret Classé.
That's still the standout for me.
Is it?
Yeah. Me too. I mean,
I just like it better. It's just,
yeah,
it's,
me too.
It's, I like the Puy Fuissé. It's, I mean, that's a good wine.
Yes,
that's
it is.
A good wine, but side by side. And if I wasn't drinking them side by side, I'd be very happy to drink
either
the
one.
Jadot, yes. Puy Fuissé.
Yeah.
But there's just more going on.
I just like it more going on.
I was actually surprised in the Puy Fuissé. I felt like there's a top and a middle, but there's no bottom note to the wine. It sort of falls apart at the bottom. And that is not the case with the Verret Classé.
I think the interesting comment we want to make maybe on these two wines is small production versus larger production. Because the Jadot as a Gauchon would be blending many plots from the village. In this whole area of Mâcon, the Mâcon village is 2/3 of it. So there's a lot of production that he could be drawing from. Whereas the Verret Classé is coming from one of two villages and so
from
smaller
André Bonhomme.
And a smaller producer, yeah.
One man's name is on the label and that means something.
At the very beginning the some wood in there I thought and some flavors of vanilla that you get often in Chardonnay wines that I thought were very pronounced. Maybe too pronounced.
In which one, Larry?
The Louis Jadot Puy Fuissé.
Puy Fuissé, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But now, as I take another glass and start to taste it, those first impressions are sort of mellowing out.
I agree.
It's actually a good example of Puy Fuissé, in my opinion. Puy Fuissé is known, I believe, in Mâcon as one of the bigger wines, one of the more famous wines, one of the better quality wines.
Yes.
And they're often fairly powerful for what they are for that region. So they have all those classic Mâcon flavors, may even more. It depends on the maker. I don't know what the price is on this bottle, but it's pretty good.
It'd be a great time for the listening audience to be reminded that two wines get confused all the time, and that is Puy Fuissé and Puy Fumé.
Mm-hmm.
And let's just like try to settle it in your minds when you go into the store to buy wine. Puy Fuissé is Chardonnay, always Chardonnay, will never be anything but Chardonnay.
From the Burgundy.
From the Burgundy area and from the Mâcon. Puy Fumé, and think when you say Fumé, it's like almost feel like smoke or whatever, but it is Sauvignon Blanc. And Sauvignon Blanc is a completely different grape. It's from the Loire River Valley.
A long way away.
Lovely wine in its own right, but quite different. If you're expecting Chardonnay and you take a sip of that, you're going to say, wow, this is really acidic. I don't know. This all I get is lemon in this, but that is the character of that wine. It's lovely in its own right, quite different from the Puy Fuissé.
So is there any sort of summary that you might want to offer up in regard to this exploration of the Chardonnay grape in the Mâcon region? Because all in all, I think it's been a very, very lovely flight of wines. I have to say the Verret Classé for me is really a lovely, that has staying power.
Yeah, you can find that one, I would say that. But I would say the whole wines for me around the experience and you know, cook, live, and love. I think these wines lend themselves to big gatherings. The price point's so reasonable on these wines for convivial evenings of food and friends.
Yes, because you could sit around the table and drink these wines for a few hours with good food and good conversation, and it would be a great way to spend an evening.
It would be.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
Yeah. We want to thank you for joining us for this hour-long inquiry into the Mâcon region and the Chardonnay grape. This program is called What's My Wine? Keith Zimmerman, Larry Burdick, Joe Canini, sitting around tasting wonderful food and drinking wonderful wines. My name is Cynthia Reeves, and this is WOOL 91.5 FM radio out of Bellows Falls. Thank you for listening.